Anyway,
you were just explaining to me that you wrote the signature composition for.
I had a solo piece. Yeah, no when to listen, countryman, and he used this as the. As the program alert, you know, play no winter, then you know it is the singing net.
For singing net.
Right.
So you really are integral to the history
yes,
of singing
yes,
net.
Yes, Henry very well. I knew him in England, you know. I was at School of Oriental and African Studies.
Yes, of course.
Yes, for 5 years.
And so you were in contact with him there?
So, no, with BBC. I did some program before BBC. In fact, we did a literary program in London, you know, for Henry, before he came here. Yeah.
So you knew him before he came to
Ghana?
So how did that begin?
Well, his colleagues were always, you know, inviting me to do programs and so forth. So, no, I got to meet him immediately he arrived. No. And because I was doing research and collecting this kind of thing, you know, I was often in contact, you know, whenever he's doing, you know. Yeah. It coincided with the period. I was a research fellow in African Studies, 1952. Mm-hmm. You know, and that period 52 to independence and so forth. You know, I became involved in the cultural programs. You know, because of meeting in London first, you know, it was quite natural for us to. Sometimes we meet in his home and that kind of thing. You know, it was easygoing. Yeah.
So that was how you first became involved in the work that was happening here, because
right.
You'd already had contact with
right,
Henry
right.
Swansea and the BBC
right,
from
right.
having been in London.
That's right.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So the Voices of Ghana anthology was published in 1958.
That's right.
And in a sense, I suppose it's a brief selection of the sort of things that were being broadcast through Radio mm-hmm. Ghana. It mm-hmm. defines its period as 1955 to 1957.
Yeah.
Do you think that the collection is representative of the types of things that were being broadcast?
Yeah, you know, especially at that time, you know, a certain awareness, you know, awareness of our traditions and culture, and also the eagerness of people to build a new tradition, you know, out of what people were writing and so forth, and a new consciousness of oral literature and so forth, you know, at that time, you know. And coinciding with the independence thing, you know, at that point, you know, we were interested in whatever we could do on our, do on our. Oh, yes.
So the contribution that we have of your work is in part a composition and an example of
right.
language.
Yes,
but
you know, of my field work I was doing, you know, recording traditional songs mm. and poetry. And I came across this big, you know, chunk of oral literature. People were aware that drums speak, but they did not know that they were also important medium for oral literature, specifically court mm-hmm. literature, and that it had an extensive, you know, materials, you know, different types of oral literature and so forth. Mm.
In introducing the piece that you obviously recorded at the time and that appears in Voices of Ghana, you explain something of your vast understanding
yeah.
of drum language and
right.
as you say, who did you imagine as your audience? Because it's there's something educating in the way that you've explained it.
Yeah, well, I suppose there was already a radio guy, I know, a radio audience, as it were. You know, BBC was, you know, preparing a number of programs, so there were listeners. And I suppose I thought at that time that I was reaching out to the literate community. But I also did other things, you know, in Ghana, in my own language. So it sort of reinforced, you know, what I was doing in the other program.
So you recorded the piece that we see in print, yeah, in Voice of Ghana. You recorded that yourself?
Yeah.
And was that typical of writers at the time? Were they recording their own poetry or?
Well, this was part of a bigger research program. You know, the drum language was just a little part of my study of traditional music. And before then, I had done a compilation of funeral dirges, mm-hmm, which, you know, I translated the key text, you know, into English, and did a critical analysis of the materials and performance traditions and so forth. And while I was doing this, I was also working on the drums. Mm-hmm. So I compiled quite a good number of drum texts and was able to see the different types and the different occasions and so forth. And because I was interested in publishing such materials, I always translated, you know, the texts, you know, and then wrote, at some point, I wrote a book on drumming in Akan communities, mm-hmm, and some of the translations I had already, you know, done for, you know, this program, included in my...
That academic work was able to translate onto a new platform.
Right. And in fact, I became active in the independence, and the events of the independence celebration, because I had these materials, you know,
yes,
bringing the traditional performers, you know, from up the ridge, you know, to Accra and that sort of thing, and developing, you know, entertainment programs were part of the independence celebration and so on.
We see in the back of the Voices of Ghana, you've just reminded me, the national anthem, and we understand from some of Henry Swansea's notes that it really was a group that were working in and around Radio Ghana at the time that became involved in that. So you were part of that.
Yeah, well, there was an interim committee for an arts council. I was on it. You know, but I was doing my work at the university in the sociology department, mm-hmm, you know, and it so happened that a lot of the things I was doing, you know, seemed relevant at the time. We were trying to celebrate, you know, independence and bringing in the drums and performing groups and, you know, and that sort of thing, yeah.
And I'd like us to get on to discussing things to do with independence and the idea of nationhood. But before we do, just coming back to this idea of audience, who do you think, more broadly, the Radio Ghana audience was intended to be? Who did the institution believe they were speaking
well,
to?
Well, you see, the fact that we had English programs and then we had vernacular programs.
Yes.
Meant that Radio Ghana was trying to reach the whole country, mm-hmm, you know, and also a selection of Ghana languages, so we had special programs, which made everybody aware of the center. If you hear a program in your language, maybe the other ones, you don't understand. Mm-hmm. You don't even understand the English, and so forth. So Radio Ghana was important for creating awareness of Ghana,
yeah,
you know, as a composite of, you know, ethnic groups and so forth, who had something worth sharing, you know, centrally through a medium like radio. You know. And the literate community was really the community involved in the independence struggle.
Yeah.
And they were leading the other people. So they would be sensitive to programs that are reminding them of their own, you know, part of the development, you know.
Yeah.
I think that we were discovering for the first time because we never really took notice of what individuals were doing. And a new consciousness that there is a link between what contemporary people were doing and the tradition itself from which they are derived. It meant that we now had a basis for thinking of African literature or African music or of African dance, African dance in terms of its own, you know, qualities and so on, you know. At the same time, complementing what we were doing in the colonial period, because we never really gave up the foundations that were laid by the colonial system. There was a certain duality of culture that emerged. We knew the context for each one, and we had people who were comfortable in both. And so a certain kind of creative synthesis, you know, began to emerge. In the music field, it started in quite early in the 1920s or so. But in the literary field, you know, we're just beginning even to look at our own literature in Cree and Benacre. And the setting up of Benacre Literature Bureau and all that, you know, came to bring a new awareness to the traditions which seem to be still relevant for a new Ghana. You know.
So you think that this idea of duality was well represented by Radio Ghana?
Yes, it was. And the encouragement that Radio Ghana gave to this was the fact that they had programs in English and programs in Ghana languages. Those in Ghana languages were what they were trying to develop, because in the colonial period, Ghana languages were not so important, you know, officially.
Of course.
And then, you know, Radio Ghana, trying to reach, you know, the entire country, you know, at this select thing, you know, which worked very well. But the source materials were in the community.
Right.
And you had your singers, you had your drummers and so forth, and you could do this. The source material for the other thing was in the contemporary context. You see, the context of new relationships, you know, lawyers, clerks, people who are in the educational system, you know, in that community. Most of whom would be bilingual,
yes,
but actively, creatively not bilingual or bicultural, and now trying to be, you know, to become really bicultural, you know, remembering, you know, the little they had, you know, from community, and now searching for, you know, traditional materials,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Like I do recordings of funeral dirges, and it comes as a new thing for my friends, because we hear people mourning and crying and so forth, but we did not think that they had such consistent ways of doing this and so forth, you know. And so a discovery of our own tradition was a part of the thing, and really well enforced by Radio Ghana's programs. And I know that the singing, my thing that was played for singing it, people heard it in many places. Even when I went on research and they say, you mentioned my name, school children would come out because they had Yanumunti, you know. So it was making an impact.
Yeah. So it was really able to reestablish some of the traditions, as well as reassessing.
Right, the beginning of reconciling ethnicity and nationhood.
Very well.
Through Radio Ghana. So, you know, every language is relevant, at least those we pick up, you know, and so forth. So you have things going side by side with English. And also, sometimes equivalent, you know, here is an English song, but here is a Ghanaian song. And so, you know, that process was extremely important for Nkrumah, you know.
Did Nkrumah have much involvement with Radio Ghana, its literary platform? Did you feel any sense of his guiding direction?
He really didn't. Well, I would say he gave people the liberty to do things, but the policy was always clear in terms of the things he supported. He took up the idea of an arts, interim arts council. You see, that meant that whatever the council suggested in terms of things from villages and so forth and so on, you know, would be the new idea of reconciling, you know, the old tradition and the contemporary situation in which we are. And if that is a policy, anytime you have that kind of mix, kind of program, you know, you are really trying to build a bridge between, you know, the three traditions and the new situation that has evolved for you know. So as a principle, this is something he's supporting. And so those who are involved in that kind of thing continue to do their work because they know that they are on the right path. So,
fascinating. Yeah. And how do you think we should understand the location of these BBC secondment personnel as part of this? You've mentioned Nkrumah's policy being enacted by Ghana, Radio Ghana, but their presence within that.
Yeah, right. The fact that we had stations, you know, inland, you know, in other parts of little places, and sometimes public relations, I mean, vans and so forth that also visited these places, you know, and passed on special messages and things like that, you know, always drawing attention to something happening in Accra, of which, you know, we are a part, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And especially the programs in our languages made the whole thing real, you see, for a lot of people. And they seem to appreciate, you know, this thing. Yeah.
But in terms of having actually, you know, employees and, you know, quite, you know, significant heads of departments that were BBC people that had come over and worked. So Henry Swansea is the example of, he was head of programmes, of course, on secondment from the BBC and was based in Accra.
Okay.
Rather than it being a partner station, working directly for and on behalf of Radio Ghana.
Yeah.
How did that work in the dynamic of the institution?
Well, I mean, for us, Henry was here, but we never really thought that he was just bringing his experience from London. The thing worked so naturally, you know, that we thought, you know, here is our program, and identifying writers and so forth. You know, for the first time, we were hearing ourselves, you know, like Radio Ghana was doing that kind of thing. You know, and also encouraging people who are talented really to do something.
So he was a very encouraging
individual. Because, you know, very few people had outlet for their creativity.
Yeah.
No. And Radio Ghana, even for the traditional people, you know, to hear yourself, you know, on the radio was quite stimulating.
In terms of literature, maybe cultural and literary programs, do you feel like he was a driving force? Because obviously radio incorporates a lot more besides the things we are thinking.
I think it was a driving force. You know, when you have a program and you are feeding it all the time with different people making contributions, you know. And then you are creating a tradition. And you of course, you create an audience too, but it is creating a tradition. Because for the first time, those involved in creative work can compare what they are doing with what they, you know. And there's certain stimulus comes from this awareness that other people are doing, you know. And so that was very important. In fact, that there was a community of writers, or such a community, the idea that such a community could emerge, you know, came from the program.
Yeah.
You see.
So it made you feel that right, whether you were a listener or a contributor.
Right, right.
A part of that.
And so that also would bring a new kind of way of looking even at what you do in institutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you learn poetry, you read what in the institution, but it is only a school, you know, program. You know, when you hear that this is something that's being broadcast, so it gives a different, you know, thing.
Yeah.
So that there's a link between the thing that we are learning and the things that we are doing, you know, and especially in terms of English literature, and so, you know, it becomes quite an interesting development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned just a moment ago the idea that perhaps Henry Swansea's role as head of programs with an interest in the literature side of things was to feed that program.
Yeah.
That makes me wonder, do you think that the kind of quality standard that he applied was of his own, was something that he'd learnt from the Ghanaians that he was working with, or was it a BBC value that he was applying?
Well, I think his experience at BBC was good, because the few people he found who could, you know, do the program for him at that time sort of provided a model, you know, and so looking out for possible contributors, mm-hmm. you know, spreading the news at his word, so people who I know, people know can. I think he was good in that sense that he really created a line of development. See, because every time people contributed, now we are listening to original writings, you know, by Ghanaians and so forth. And it was a new concept. I mean, even to think of it as Ghanaian literature,
yes,
in the beginning, you know, in the making.
Yes.
And that really, I think, was what he had in mind. But he was so informal, you know, that people, you know, responded, you know, to his things quite, easily. So, I mean, he carried this on, and every time, became little piece. You know.
Do you think that the priority of this community of writers that you're talking about, of which we can include Swansea, but not perhaps isolate him as an individual, do you think that their priority was the recognition of, let's say, ancestral identity, or developing a collective Ghanaian sense of nation?
I think when you come to look at individuals like Ifwa Sutherland,
yes,
then you can see the connection between what Henry did and his development.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ifwa also interested in poetry and so forth, was writing her own poems. But somehow he had the urge, to bring this together, to develop a magazine, a journal, That and the other thing, really brought, the literary thing, to the center.
So you think on the back of programs like Singing Net, the development of the magazine true written publication.
And also the Ministry of Information, helped, because they had the vans and they had a support for little things that people wrote in their magazine. And so those things coming together and the kind of new interest in tradition and how you show this in literature and so forth. Some of the poems like African Heaven and so forth, showing a pride for traditional culture, the drums and so forth, but put in a very interesting kind of way, so you are proud of it and you're boasting and so forth. But this in a literary form, mm-hmm. Expressing the new interest in Ghanaian culture and the Ghanaian, being the Ghanaian, So, I mean, this was really Voices of Ghana, not only in the sense that we were listening to individual poems, but a certain way of looking at themselves in terms of an independent country. It's very much in our days. And the important thing too was that people were beginning to develop their own styles. Mm-hmm. I mean, you learn to write English poetry, but your models are from the English literature. And as soon as you discover how to do things in your own way, or your own turn of phrases, your own imagery and so forth, you are beginning to transfer that institutional experience you had in school to something that is closer to your environment and so forth. Yeah. And that thing was very important. And you will also find that some of the early people who were writing English poetry, in fact, were following the British style very closely, as a model. But the contemporary writers, following them, were trying to find their own way of expressing their feelings and so forth. And that, I think, was very important. It was the same in music, that you sang Western hymns and Western anthems and so forth. But as soon as you discovered your own music, were trying to create a synthesis, bringing in this and that, And so the knowledge of the other one becomes something that drives you to find your own and so forth. And so a certain consciousness, not just of nationalism, but of what is worthy in your tradition. Mm-hmm.
So this is all part of this sense of finding a new interest in the tradition.
Right, so that you have a new creative outlook. A creative outlook, which formerly only looked at the Western introduction, but now see that differently in terms of its impact or what it can do in terms of looking at your own materials from the same point of view. Yeah.
As you've mentioned, there were programs in Akan, Ewe, mm-hmm. Gara Dagmi, Dagmani and Hausa,
the six recognized
mm-hmm. languages besides English.
Yes.
So in terms of what you're explaining here at the moment, would you therefore say that there was the programs that were in English were perhaps of an Akan style and form, but in English, rather than it being English literature.
Right, right.
And that
was
what was being developed.
I think that was what was. In this case, you know, it happens not because it is a mistake. A person is making a mistake, but he's doing it deliberately out of his understanding of the process he has learned.
So that becomes a creative form.
Right, it becomes a creative. You know, the thing that really inspires African literature, you know, you may not see directly, but you know, the habit of thinking in a particular sort of way that you develop when you're reading, you know, English poem and so forth, you know, if you transfer that to another location, you know, you're still going through the same creative process, but you do it with different materials. And it sort of shapes your growth. You know, your early poems may be very close to the English style, but as you go on, because you are mastering the technique, you begin to be, you know, more productive and so forth. Yeah.
So what do you think the greatest challenge was for writers at that time in terms of reconciling the things that you're mentioning to us now?
Well, I think any time I look at this Voices of Ghana, I'm interested in the kind of topics that people chose to deal with, you know. As they were looking at their own culture, their own traditions and so forth, you know, and finding a way of describing some of these in poetic terms, you know, it was quite a challenge, you know. Thinking about, you know, your vegetation, your own vegetation instead of the one in the literature and things like that, you know. Yeah. In other words, the process of becoming, well, I'm going to say the process of becoming not traditional, but, you know, African in the sense that you are conscious of certain values, you know, that you did not think of, but have become aware because of your exposure to another culture that, you know, that brought it to your mind. You know. That, you know, process, you know, comes through all the time. And so this duality is a creative, you know, I think, because it enables because it enables people to use whatever technique they come across to explore it, you know, using their own materials. You know. And I think it was and they paved the way for those who are not able really to think of how to create the synthesis, because the models then come from those who have done it, and you doing it, you know, with ease and so forth. So now there are more writers, young writers and so forth, than before, you know. And what they learn at school seems to make sense in terms of the transfer and so forth, that you can write your own poem and things like that. Yeah.
So the impact of that era, of that period of a writing community coming together and functioning within that dualism, what impact do you think that's had on a more modern Ghanaian literary form?
Oh, I think it's gone very far. And not only the Ghanaian thing, the literary forms from other African countries, you know, where really good writers emerged, they were also providing models and reinforcing whatever people were doing in Ghana. But actually, and others, you know, were appreciated because they were used, you know, facing a different environment. And you could see where they come from when they write. And it's, you know, you know. So the fact that, you know, what people in other African countries were writing also became accessible through this process, you know. Well, it's very important in bringing the concept of African literature, which could be diverse in terms of the diversity in Africa itself, but around it is a common experience. And coming from the colonial thing and what it offered and what we can now reject and so forth and so on. And what are the equivalents, you know, and things like that. Yeah.
You mentioned Achebe as an example. Nigerian literature has arguably been globally, you know, more prominent than,
right,
than Ghanaian literature.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they were more forthright in picking up the symbols of their own culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether in terms of even terms that they would use or sentiments and so forth. They seem to have been closer to their languages, you know, and what their languages give them, you know, than we were. I don't know why. But perhaps it reflects the extent to which the, you know, the Nigerian writers were themselves immersed in their own languages.
Right. And so being able to use their own tradition through English.
Right. I think that we were not really so immersed, you know, in our own languages. And it wasn't those who were writing Cree poems and Cree stories, really, who converted who became writers of English literature.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite different. And so those who were, they were able to think of their own traditional idioms and so forth, did not transform or translate this into English, as it were. And so that their African identity could not come into what they were doing immediately, you see, because they separated the two.
So do you think that's something that has been unique to the coming together of the different groups to form Ghana?
Yeah.
Part of the struggle for a national identity here?
Yeah, well, I think here, I think the missionary thing was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the educational, the level of it was very high. And if you get into it, well, if you are a bright person, it sets you thinking. But if you are not, you know, you take what you find, and that is what you try to reproduce. So that's where the problem is. Those who were intelligent and so forth were writing, you know, when they became conscious of themselves, were writing protests, you know, protests, you know, why are we doing this, instead of being creative, you see. They were more concerned with the politics of the situation than with the creative, you know, thing in the...
And in terms of the politics of the situation, if we're talking about this mid-1950s era in particular, do you think it was right that there was a guiding force from these, you know, British people from the field, that someone like Henry Swansea was taking his own part in developing?
Yeah, because... throughout the colonial period, there were people who became interested in what they found in the colonies. In fact, some of them were thinking creatively. What, for example, who was a historian and a musician, suddenly became interested in African music. In fact, he was perhaps among the first people really to talk about African music in writing, and to write an article on music, because they had become conscious of the differences and style and so forth. And in fact, became very important in terms of their relationship to Ghanaians. The one person, Emu, who broke out of the eating, became a friend of this man, And so, in fact, Emu was converting his Western experience in music, to the African thing that he has now discovered, and became a very strong person in creating a new kind of style, song style and so forth. But at the same time, not quite able to divorce himself from the other experience, so selecting what he thought would fit this thing. So creating a synthesis like that all along, until he found what exactly made his music different.
Right, and different in the sense that it has a Ghanaian
identity. That's right. And so whatever he borrows, whatever ideas he gets, something remains in the music all the time as the foundation. And these things come as extensions and so forth. So that process, of discovering, we may say discovering your roots,
yes.
Then the other things, that come are hanging, embellishing, giving it a new kind of look and so forth. But the root, remains there.
We really seem to have a Sankofa situation,
right,
where we're looking back to go forward at
this
time.
That's really interesting. That's right.
So, finally, one last question. Who do you believe has been Ghana's most successful author? And on what grounds are you judging their success?
Well, this is something I haven't really considered from that point of view, except that Atukwe Okan, for example, is well known because he has developed his individual style. Other people are known to this, but they're not quite as individual as Atukwe Okan. And anywhere he gets up to recite, people anticipate what he'll do, even his gestures and the pauses and so forth. Everything is sort of, I would say stylized, but it is his personality. So he is well known in Ghana. There are the other writers, that people know, but not in the same sense. Also, Atukwe Okan was easy with English language, in the sense that he could create, combinations of sounds. He had this aesthetic, sense where the sounds of the language were as important as the ideas.
So performance
was integral to his
success.
So he has that comes into his work. So that gives him a kind of unique thing. So with Wally and so forth, for them the metaphors and so forth, the Yoruba way of it becomes the thing. But in the case of Tukwe, the stylistic, the sounds of the language are also things that he tries to manipulate. Is conscious of that level, the sonorities of the language, you know, so he can work with that, you know, choose certain words or modify it because of that, you know.
So with your mention of performance, would you argue that radio has provided a better platform for literature than the written word?
Well, I think so. Written word, you know, only a few individuals, you know, who have a reading habit. Mm-hmm. But this thing comes, radio, you know, somehow, you know, culturally, you know, we the things that we hear and so, you know, are extremely important. Because we even try to create sounds, you know, because the listening thing is very active, more so than what what you see, you know. So that sensitivity, you know, when it comes into the sounds and so forth, because those structures, those sounds are also in our languages, and we do respond, you know, even in terms of gestures and movements and so on, you know. To this.
So in terms of responding to this sense of duality that we've discussed, then radio allows for something of the character of something traditional, even if the words are being presented in English.
Yeah, certainly hearing somebody's voice, you know, makes him closer to you than reading his writing.
Professor Nketiah, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.